Okay, well, sometimes it can seem like it's hard going being a revolutionary in Australia today. That despite our efforts, despite our determination, it's slow going in terms of building a serious revolutionary organisation with real roots in the working class movement. Now, the story of American Trotskyism in the late 1920s and throughout the 1930s is similar to our own in a lot of ways. But they attempted to build an organisation in circumstances that I think were much more difficult than the ones that we face. To be a Trotskyist in the US at that time meant, to take a stand on the basis of principles meant breaking with the established communist movement. It meant facing isolation, it meant facing slander and attacks. But the first few years of American Trotskyism is also a story of a group of revolutionaries that persevered, that held together a core of people committed to the politics so that when the political situation did open up for them, when there were opportunities to grow, they were able to seize them, and in the process they not only were able to defend the genuine Marxist tradition of socialism from below, which was an important achievement in and of itself, but they were also able to establish a substantial Trotskyist organisation on which future generations of socialists were able to build. So a key day in the story about American Trotskyism is 1928. On October 27th, 1928, three leading figures of the American Communist Party, James Buchanan, Max Shackman, Martin O'Byrne, declared their support for Leon Trotsky, for which they were immediately expelled from the Communist Party. 1928 is also the year when Stalin completely consolidated his power within Russia, overseeing the complete reversal of all of the gains of that the working class had won in the 1917 revolution. And it's also around this time that Trotsky's left opposition, which had been battling against Stalin's rise to power, were expelled from the party, and it's when also around this period that Trotsky is exiled from Russia. For those left oppositionists that remained within Russia itself, they were sent to Stalin's gulag of labour camps, where most of them would perish. Well, up until 1928, the American communists had been relatively ignorant of the debates that were surrounding Trotsky's battle against Stalin. All of them had voted to condemn Trotsky throughout the 1920s, including Cannon, as a matter of course, not because they thought Trotsky was some devil incarnate, but because they were trying to garner the backing of the Communist Party, the Comintern, in the sort of internal disputes that were raging within the highly factionalised American Communist Party. But by the late 1920s, Cannon started to feel uneasy about and disgruntled about the direction of the American Party. But despite his unease, he wasn't really clear what the roots of the problem were, that you couldn't understand the problem just by looking at the situation of what was going on in the US itself, that the roots of the problem lay in the degeneration of the revolution in Russia itself. And what's more, at this stage, Cannon didn't have an alternative program on which to organise opposition around. But in June 1928, all of this changed when he attended the 6th Congress of the Communist International. And by accident, at this Congress, Cannon got a hold of Trotsky's critique of the draft program of the Communist International. And this critique had slipped through the censors' net, had been translated, and luckily found itself in Cannon's lap. And Cannon was immediately impacted by what Trotsky had written, by his critique of Stalin's theory of socialism in one country, and Trotsky's argument that internationalism wasn't just some nice, optional extra, but it was absolutely necessary in the struggle against the globalised capitalist economy. So although this document was stamped read and return, Cannon was able to smuggle it back into the US. He actually put it inside a children's toy, inside a teddy, and was able to get it back into the US. And when he was back in the US, in New York, he kept this precious document in his bedroom and invited trusted comrades around to read it in one sitting. And it was through this process that he was able to win over to Trotsky's positions Shackman O'Byrne and a woman called Rose Kastner, who at that time was the secretary of a mass organisation that the communists had backed called the International Labour Defence Organisation. Okay, at first these people tried to build support within, amongst the sort of ranks of the Communist Party secretly by, this sort of process of getting people to read and then winning them over. But this process didn't last very long. within, you know, a couple of weeks, there were real accusations of Trotskyism flying around, and the party put them on trial, and they attempted to drag out the trial to get as much publicity throughout the ranks of the party about their stand, but they were eventually thrown out of the party. Now, in an attempt to deride these expelled Trotskyists, the Communist Party labelled them the three generals without an army. But soon their ranks were reinforced with dozens of other Communist Party members who were expelled on the spot for simply querying the expulsions of Cannon and the rest. Now, most of these people who were expelled had very little understanding of what Trotskyism was about. Really, they just balked at the lack of internal democracy within the party. But once they were freed from the Communist Party's discipline, a lot of them went and searched out what their supposed crime was and were won over to Trotsky's criticisms. So soon the Trotskyists had small groupings not only in New York, which is where Cannon and the rest were, but they also had groupings throughout dozens of cities in the US. So this is also how they were able to get a core of people in Minneapolis who were long-standing trade union militants that were to go on to play a very leading role in a big strike in 1934. So in his book, The History of American Trotskyism, which is by James Cannon, and it's based on a series of lectures that Cannon gave in 1942 based on the history of this split and their attempts to build an organisation. He talks about the significance of the American split for not just for, you know, building a revolutionary organisation in the US itself, but for Trotskyism internationally. It was important in the way that it lifted the spirits, it lifted the morale of left opposition groups across the world, and particularly in Russia itself, where, you know, there were Trotskyists who were in jail, who got to hear news of the fact that there had been some major stand taking place in what is one of the most important countries in the world, in the US. And this encouraged them to continue their fight against Stalinism. And to quote Cannon, he says, "Overnight, the whole picture, the whole perspective of the struggle changed. Trotskyism, officially pronounced dead, was resurrected on the international arena." Now, from 1928 until 1933, the expelled Trotskyists didn't see themselves as a rival party to the Communist Party. Rather, they saw themselves as an oppositional faction, a faction which had been expelled but was still seeking re-entry into the party. And this conception was wholly in line with Trotsky's. He had thought up until 1933 that the Russian state was still reformable, that the communist parties around the world could still be won to revolution, and that through a process of, you know, their critique, through their process of argument, coupled with events in the world, that they would be able to shift the communist parties back towards revolutionary policies. So for the American Trotskyists, seeing themselves as an opposition faction meant directing their arguments and propaganda towards the rank-and-file members of the Communist Party instead of, say, attempting to address the working class as a whole or just random individuals. This way, for instance, this is why they, within a week of being expelled from the Communist Party, had set up their own paper, which they called The Militant, and they went down to the Communist Party headquarters in Union Square to try and flog it, try and get the rank and file members of the Communist Party to buy it. And they were chased away, actually, by Communist Party members of the Fur Workers Union. This is what, you know, it wasn't glamorous work, but they were trying to influence these people. Obviously, another compelling reason for the Trotskyists to focus on a narrow audience was their small size. With only about 100 members in the first couple of years of their existence, the Trotskyists couldn't hope to be able to provide the leadership of the working class. If they wanted to build an organisation capable of doing this, they needed to try and win over the rank-and-file members of the Communist Party. And this was because these people represented the vanguard of the American working class, that within the ranks of the Communist Party, there were sincere revolutionaries who had been won to revolutionary politics in the aftermath of the 1917 Russian Revolution. These were sincere revolutionaries who, in the main, continued to play a leading role in the class struggle in the US. So the Trotskyists couldn't just bypass these leading elements. Not everyone who left the Communist Party, though, adopted this sensible perspective. Some people, such as Albert Weisbord, wanted to declare a new party straight away and to do mass work. But considering, you know, he only had a tiny grouping of people around him, that this sort of mass work really only amounted to empty sloganeering. And within a few years, Wiseboard's group had disappeared completely from the scene. But Cannon notes in his history that it wasn't just Wiseboard who was impatient. He says, find the page. In those days, we were continually pestered by impatient people in our ranks. The difficulties of the time pressed heavily upon us. Week after week, month after month, we appeared to be gaining hardly an inch. Discouragement set in, and with it, the demand for some scheme to grow faster, some magic formula. We fought it down, talked it down, and held our group on the right line. Kept its face turned to the one possible source of healthy growth, the ranks of the communist workers, who still remained under the influence of the Communist Party. And indeed, I think it's impressive that Cannon, Shachtman, Annaburn made the transition to patient and often unrewarding propaganda work because, you know, one of the reasons why the Communist Party called them the Three Generals and why this remark stung was the fact that they had been leading members in the Communist Party. They had been used to addressing a mass audience. And I think this was particularly true of Cannon. Cannon was a working-class figure with considerable stature. And if you just get a bit of a sense of the brief outlines of his life, he was born in 1890 into a poor family who were first-generation Irish immigrants. And they were born in he was born in Rosedale, Kansas, in the Midwest. By the age of 12, he dropped out of school to work in a meatpacking factory. And by the age of 18, he joined the Socialist Party alongside such celebrated figures in American working-class radicalism such as Eugene Debs and Big Bill Haywood. 3 years later, in 1911, he joined the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, to become what they called a hobo rebel, where he'd go around traipsing the countryside, agitating for strikes, leading big battles of labour versus capital, organising the unorganised in Ohio, Illinois, Minnesota and so on. So by 1919, when he'd helped found the Communist Party, Cannon was already a figure that was marked by considerable experience in the class struggle. And then within the Communist Party itself, he was, from its inception, a member of the Central Committee of the party, and he also was the he also led a faction within the Communist Party that commanded something like a third of the party members' support, including some of the party's best trade union activists. But as an isolated Trotskyist, Cannon had to learn to adjust to the new realities. So the fact that he developed what I think is a sensible perspective, that he had a sensible idea about what a small group was capable of doing, what the audience was, what the tasks at hand were, I think this is a tribute to him. But it has to be said that despite having a sensible perspective and despite being right that Stalin was strangling the revolution, the going was very tough for the American Trotskyists in the first few years. And so by May 1929, when the Trotskyists officially launched their faction, which they called the Communist League of America, left opposition of the Communist Party, they had only 100 members. And generally they found it hard to recruit rank-and-file Communist Party members after the initial influx that they got through the expulsions. So why was this? Well, to begin with, the communist rank-and-file weren't just going to break from the party that they dedicated their life to just because of some mistakes that the Communist Party were making or because of some rumours about what Stalin was up to. What outweighed these mistakes and what outweighed these rumours was the party's enduring authority, an authority that was based on the fact that in the eyes of millions, they continued to carry the mantle of the Russian Revolution, the only successful workers' revolution to date. Another factor was the campaign of physical and verbal intimidation that the CP directed at the Trotskyists. So in terms of physical intimidation, in Cannon's history, he talks about how whenever they tried to hold public meetings in downtown New York, thugs from the Communist Party would go not just to scream down their speakers, but they'd go with baseball bats, with knuckle dusters and knives, trying to break up their public meetings. And so to be able to have public meetings, you had to organise your members into a militia with the support of other left-wingers who supported your right to freedom of speech to try and protect the speaker. And in terms of verbal abuse, the Trotskyists were called counter-revolutionaries. They were constantly denounced as enemies of the working class, and they were actually refused entry into most working class organisations and organisations of the unemployed. They were socially isolated from what had previously been their comrades in the Communist Party, and so there's stories about how there were neighbourhoods that they couldn't walk down, or relatives and family members that wouldn't speak to them because they had broken from the party. So you can see that to be a Trotskyist, you had to be able to be prepared to break from an organisation of some thousands to join a tiny organisation where you'd be physically attacked, slandered and socially ostracised from your family and friends. However, I think the most important reason why they found the going tough in terms of connecting with the rank and file of the CP was the impact of Stalin's third period, which was a communist a Comintern policy that was declared in around 1928. Before the third period, the Trotskyist criticisms of the CP had been based on the sort of conservative line that the Communist Party were following. And they'd actually been gaining a bit of a hearing on that basis. So they criticised Stalin's directives to Communist parties that they should be making alliances with all and sundry, with reformist trade union leaders, with bourgeois nationalists, and so on. But in 1928, there was a sea change in Comintern policy. Stalin declared that revolution was now imminent across the world, and that the forces that they'd only yesterday been currying favour with, the reformists and existing union leaders, these people were now the biggest props of imperialism around the world, and indeed they were denounced as social fascists, so that they were in many ways even worse than the fascists because they were more better at duping the workers. And part of this third period policy was also about setting up what they call, instead of like working within the existing unions, setting up breakaway unions or what they called red unions. So all of this sort of language about imminent revolution, about setting up red revolutionary unions, denouncing the reformists as fascists, all sounded very radical. It gave the Communist Party a radical gloss. However, the shift in Comintern policy had absolutely nothing to do with the state of the class struggle around the world, or indeed about the political characterisation of the reformists and so on. Instead, what it reflected was a power struggle that was going on within the Russian ruling class, with Stalin and the bureaucratic machine that he built up around him deciding to junk their previous policy of concessions to the peasantry and promotion of free market style policies towards a policy of rapid industrialisation based on ratcheting up the exploitation of the working class and forced collectivisation of agriculture. So, a real squeezing of the peasantry. And this was all about trying to build up the Russian economy so that it could compete militarily, really, with the West. But they needed a left cover to be able to implement this program, and that's what the sort of language of the third period is about. So the brutality of what they called the five-year plan of this rapid industrialisation wasn't really known at this stage. Instead, the boldness of the plan, along with the radical rhetoric, really fired the imagination of American Communist Party members. This was, after all, the period of the Great Depression, when Western capitalism appeared to be disintegrating around them. And at this stage, in contrast to the state of Western capitalism, was the Russian economy that was going full steam ahead. So this really bolstered Stalin's appeal. So in the face of all of this canon and the Trotskyist criticisms of socialism in one country and their demands that people go back to the book and clarify their theory really just seemed like, negative hair splitting. It didn't really really connect. Although the Communist Party's third period policies were incredibly sectarian, and no doubt they cut themselves off from being able to connect with tens of thousands of workers in the US who still were, still felt an allegiance to the trade union leaders or to the Democrats or whatever. They were cut off from these people. But they still were able to connect with a certain mood that was going on in the US at the time. And so they were able to recruit really quite rapidly. So, for instance, by 1934, the CP could now claim 26,000 members, and this is in comparison to something like 7,300 members that they had in 1928, so it was quite a big expansion. So for the Trotskyists, the third period close the political space for them. It cut the ground from beneath them. And individual recruitment basically dried up in this period in sort of the early 30s. And this period is called, by canon, the dog days of the left opposition because the going was so tough. And this is also the period where there's faction fights within the Communist League, this real turning inwards, endless sort of squabbling and so on, based really, I think, on frustration that they weren't going forward. But still, they managed to hold it together. They managed to keep a core of people in this organisation. They managed to survive these difficult early years. And this was absolutely important because by 1933, the objective political situation had presented some real opportunities for the Trotskyists to be able to grow. Now, this opportunity in 1933 wasn't based on some upturn in the class struggle. It was based on a political opening that was a product of the crisis that was caused by Hitler's ascension to power. So when Hitler came to power, the fact that the largest communist party in the world, the largest social democratic party in the world, in Germany, put up barely any resistance to Hitler's rise, really created a lot of consternation and questioning amongst sort of the ranks of radical people around the world. How could this tragedy happen? And it was Trotsky who really stood out as having the answers to these questions. Now, obviously, I can't go into what Trotsky really said about how to understand fascism as a political phenomenon or what he argued were the tactics that the Communist Party should have implemented to fight the rise of fascism. But suffice to say, the clarity and the brilliance of Trotsky's writing really created a lot of more prestige for Trotsky and for Trotskyists around the world. So, for the Communist League, this meant that instead of talking to forums of, a few dozen or talking to tiny little study groups, they now started to draw much larger crowds to listen to what they had to say about the crisis in Germany. So at the beginning of 1933, for instance, the Communist League held a meeting in the Bronx, which was the start of a nationwide speaking tour, and they were able to attract 500 people to this meeting. In this period, the Communist League experienced some modest growth. They grew from 100 to 150 for the first time. And they also attracted some very prominent New York intellectuals, people like James T. Farrell and others. And these people had been around the Communist Party or members of the Communist Party. And as a result of the sectarianism of the CP in the third period, but also the crisis around Germany were won over to supporting the Trotskyists. So 1933 signals an end to the dog days for the Trotskyists, but it's also another important marker. This year is the year that Trotsky concludes that the road to political reform of the Communist Parties and of the Comintern is now closed, that the absolutely disastrous role of the German Communist Party in following Stalin's directives, that they shouldn't unite with the Social Democratic Party in physically confronting the Nazis, and the fact that communist parties around the world basically submitted to this outrage without any sort of deep reaction, without really any kind of questioning, with utter obedience, meant that Trotsky concluded that these parties could no longer be won to the road of revolution. So instead of reform, he argues there needs to be a political revolution in Russia that overthrows the bureaucracy, and he argues that there needs to be new parties and a new international built to challenge Stalinism. And so he declares the need for a fourth international. So the Trotskyist small but important growth that they had in 1933, and more importantly, the fact that I think they regained their confidence and were starting to feel like they had forward momentum, meant that they could then seize the opportunities that opened up in 1934. Now, these opportunities were opportunities now based on an upswing in the class struggle. Because at first, the Great Depression hadn't produced all of this industrial struggle. The working class were initially demoralised and atomised by the skyrocketing rates of unemployment. And those workers that did maintain their jobs keenly felt their loss of industrial power and were really reticent to go on strike. That's not to say there weren't battles in the early 30s. There were more things like hunger marches or battles of the unemployed against evictions and so on. But 1934 is a turning point. And in this year, there are three major strikes that are led by socialists of one form or another. And these strikes really signal a new mood of combativity that was sweeping the American working class. And these key strikes, all of which developed into citywide general strikes, were the Toledo Auto Light Strike, which involved workers in the auto parts industry, the San Francisco Dock Workers Strike, and finally the infamous Teamsters Strike, which centred on the truckers in Minneapolis. Now, the success of these strikes helped to spark a nationwide revival in militancy, which really reached a level that's been unparalleled, unrivaled in American history to date. From 1934 till 1937, millions rushed to join the unions. Hundreds of thousands went on strike for increases in wages, for union recognition, a whole host of other demands. And hundreds of thousands of others also engaged in sit-down strikes or factory occupations in this period. So it gives you a sense of the radicalism of that period. Now, 1934 wasn't just a turning point in terms of the fortunes of American labour. It's also a breakthrough year for the American Communist League because it's their members, their rank-and-file members in Minneapolis and the trucking industry that lead the Minneapolis strike. These people were the Dunn brothers, Miles, Vincent and Grant Dunn, and the Swedish socialist Carl Skoglund. Now, these people, as I said, were long-term trade union militants who'd been doing lots of work in the trucking industry in the area, and these were the people that had been expelled from the Communist Party in 1928 alongside Cannon. And these rank-and-file leaders were given important political support by the central leadership of the Trotskyists, who rushed to Minneapolis as soon as they heard, from New York, as soon as they recognised what an opportunity this strike was for building their profile and reputation across the country. And they did this in large part because also they had been burnt from previous experience. Earlier that year in New York, there'd been a hotel workers' strike where one of their newer members had quickly risen to prominence. He was able to speak French, and there were French chefs that were striking. He could relate to them. And, he all of a sudden was the secretary of the local union. And he started to think he was a big mass leader now, and he no longer had to take the directives of the Communist League, and he started making all these shoddy compromises. And in the middle of the strike, so the Communist League had been incredibly isolated. You know, this is still the beginnings of the opening up. They decide to expel this guy from the party to make it clear that they took no responsibility for the sellouts that this guy was making. So they didn't want to make the same mistake again. Now, if people want an in-depth analysis of what happened in the Teamsters strike, then you should go to Liam Ward's talk, which is happening on Sunday on the Teamster Rebellion. So it's going to go through all of the juicy details. But I just wanted to briefly mention some of the key things I think the Trotskyist leadership provided that strike and why it was what was central to its victory. Okay, so the Trotskyists were committed from beginning to end to rank-and-file control of the strike instead of the trade union bureaucrats being in control. So this meant that they helped to establish the strike committee of 75 rank-and-file truck drivers who would direct the strike, and they also made decisions at nightly mass meetings that all of the workers were allowed to attend. They also kept the rank-and-file mobilised throughout the strike, involving them in cruising picket lines where they'd go and confront trucks that were trying to scab on the strike. They also knew that it was important that the strike didn't just centre on the truckers, that it had to spread and involve other workers in the town. So they helped to organise for solidarity action from the construction workers and also from the taxi drivers. They had used their previous work in the unemployed workers' movement as well to get them to support the strike rather than scabbing on it. They organised women, the wives, the partners, the supporters of the strike, into a women's auxiliary who also went out and physically confronted the scabs, but also organised the hospital and organised the kitchen that was central to feeding the thousands of strikers. The Trotskyists also published a daily strike bulletin called the Daily Organiser, and this was actually the first daily strike bulletin ever in the world around a strike. And it was regarded as a really important weapon in the strike because usually when workers on strike, they're constantly being bombarded by lies of the capitalist press and being kind of, they can be demoralised by that. So you know, to combat these arguments, to keep the morale of the strikers high, to keep them informed, this daily strike bulletin was absolutely central to that. It was Matt Shakman and Trotskyists who wrote basically this strike bulletin. And finally, the Trotskyist leadership meant that the strike wasn't derailed by the Democrats and mediators. Roosevelt had set up this labour board and was sending mediators across the country to try and get the strike leaders to sell out on the strike to try and derail it. But because the Trotskyists, you know, were politically astute, they knew what Roosevelt was attempting to do, they knew that the strike could only be won through the force of the rank and file themselves, they didn't... They weren't disoriented by this. And they also weren't disoriented when the local governor, the governor of Minnesota, who was actually a member of the Farmers' Labor Party, which was meant to be to the left of the Roosevelt's Democrats, this guy had originally supported the strike. He'd donated $500 to the strike fund. He had declared, "I'm no liberal, I'm a radical." But, you know, as the strike wore on, as it involved more and more bloody confrontations, he changed his tune and actually declared martial law. And so, you know, many other strike leaders and workers would have been completely, you know, disoriented by this turnabout. But instead, the Trotskyists were able to hold their ground, and it was Olson, the governor, in the end, who had to back down. So the marvellous role of the Trotskyists in Minneapolis showed that what was possible if the class struggle was led by those who really wanted to fight and who had a clarity of politics. And it was through the strike that the Trotskyists actually recruited 40 people in Minneapolis, including Farrell Dobbs, who's the person who wrote Teamster Rebellion, the sort of famous account, first-hand account of the Teamster Rebellion. And so this gave the Trotskyists an important base. And the leading role that they played in the strike also transformed them, their image, their profile, their reputation across the country. So instead of being considered just a bunch of students and intellectuals with their abstract theories about internationalism, all of a sudden they were seen as working class militants capable of providing the leadership of what is regarded as one of the most important strikes in American history. So to capitalise on their newfound profile and respect, the Communist League proposed a fusion with another grouping of socialists. These were a grouping around an ex-preacher, who'd been radicalised, called A.J. Must, and his group was called the American Workers' Party. So this party had just also led the Toledo Auto Light Strike, which happened around the same time as the Teamster Strike in 1934, and they'd organised mass demonstrations of the unemployed to go and join with the strikers on the picket line to confront the National Guard that had been set in. So this was a group that was, you know, moving to the left and involved a lot of young militants that the Trotskyists wanted to reach out to. And so by the end of 1934, Cannon and Shakman convinced Must that they should form a joint organisation, which they called the Workers' Party of the United States. Now, this organisation, which was around, Cannon was able to establish that it would be around a Trotskyist program, could claim a membership of around 1,000 members. Well, the figures are kind of a bit fudgy, but I saw one report of 1,000. So this fusion was, you know, quite an important step forward for the Trotskyists in terms of founding a substantial organisation. Yet they were still considerably smaller than the Communist Party, and so by the end of 1934, they, to try and establish a more sizable organisation, the Workers' Party of the United States, the New Trotskyist Party, enters the Socialist Party, which had been a long-standing organisation, previously being much bigger than it was. It was degenerating. And it was a party of kind of the reformists controlling the leadership, but a lot of still good rank-and-file members within that party. And so they wanted to enter that party to try and win the left of the Socialist Party to then split away and form a much bigger organisation. So this tactic was called the French Turn, or the entrism, and this was actually called the French Turn because the French Trotskyists attempted to do it first. And this manoeuvre has been much debated, and there's a lot of pros and cons about going into the Socialist Party. I think it's really difficult to establish a firm assessment of whether it was the right thing to do. But in terms of the positive things, when they were expelled within sort of nearly 2 years of being in the Socialist Party, when they were expelled from it, And when they formed a new organisation at the beginning of 1938, they'd actually doubled their size, doubled their membership. So they now claimed around 2,500 members. And most of this increase was from the fact that they won over pretty much wholesale the entire youth section of the Socialist Party. But it wasn't just the youth that they won. They also were able to establish a presence in the auto workers' union. So they were able to win over key militants in this union, people such as Kermit and Janora Johnson. Now, these were the people that had been central to the 1936 Flint sit-down strike. They'd masterminded the tactics that were central to that sit-down strike's victory, and Janora was the person who organised the famous women's auxiliary that that battled the National Guard and the strike breakers. So these were really quite impressive people for the Trotskyists to be able to win over. They were also able to establish a small sort of grouping as well in the San Francisco Dock Workers Union as well, out of a strike that happened in 1937. And they didn't just gain in terms of numbers. They also made an important contribution to the defence of Trotsky on the international stage while they were inside the Socialist Party. So to use their connections, they established an inquiry into Stalin's charges against Trotskyism, that he was some fascist in pay of, you know, the Germans or some Western government or whoever. And they established a commission that was headed by a preeminent liberal philosopher called John Dewey, the guy who established the Dewey Decimal System. This hearing happened in Mexico, and he heard from Trotsky himself, who played, you know, this was an important commission because it really revealed the crimes of Trotsky and was central to rescuing Trotsky on an international stage. And I think it's hard to kind of imagine today, like, the importance of this commission, because Stalin's crimes are widely known. But you've got to remember that 1936, 1937 is before Khrushchev's secret speech. It's before, you know, a lot of the sort of revelations about what, you know, the crimes of Trotsky. And it's a period when crimes of Stalin... No, Stalin's renegade. Okay. this is a period where the... It wasn't just the communists who were trying to defend Stalin. It was actually pretty much the entirety of the liberal intelligentsia were backing Stalin's Moscow trials. So in 1936, I think it was this year, there was something like 150 liberal intellectuals who published an ad in the magazine called The Nation, which is still a leading liberal newspaper in the US. And they published this ad supporting the Moscow trials and denouncing Trotsky. So that gives you a sense of the isolation of Trotsky, the fact that he was battling this, you know, feeling that it was alone on the world stage. So the fact that the Trotskyists could establish this, you know, well-publicised commission was an important feat. But, of course, there was a negative side to their entry work within the Socialist Party. They, for one, overestimated the size of the left of the Socialist Party. They thought it was much bigger, so there was less people to go in and try and find. They stayed in the Socialist Party really for way too long, because this period when they're inside the Socialist Party, hunkered down, fighting it out, under siege from the right-wing leadership of the Socialist Party, this coincided exactly with the period of, you know, the explosion in class struggle in the US, 1936-1937. And, you know, this is really the biggest upsurge that's ever happened in American working-class history. And Cannon admits that, he says, except in a few localities, we let the great movement of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, pass over our heads. Now, considering their small size, it would have been difficult for the Trotskyists to be able to make much of an impact on this strike wave. But the fact that they basically totally ignored the strike wave, it just meant that they gave the Communist Party open slather to establish their dominance within the working class movement. And this is precisely what the Communist Party did. So by 1938, the Communist Party could claim 82,000 members and 100,000 in their youth league. So this was, you know, a period where the Communist Party established their suffocating hegemony over the leading elements of the working class. And it wasn't just a problem for the Trotskyists, it was also a major problem for the class struggle, because it meant that the communists used, you know, with their crap politics, basically led the class struggle down a dead alley. This is now the period of the Popular Front, back again to making alliances with all and sundry, and not just reformist trade union leaders, but supposedly progressive capitalists like Roosevelt. And so in an attempt to maintain these alliances, they restrained the movement, demobilised it, called off strikes, and so on. So the amazing opportunities that existed in the late 30s were squandered by the politics and the role of the Communist Party. So this really brings me to my conclusion. So I've covered the first 10 years of the American Trotskyists. And in terms of the sort of key points that I think we should be thinking about, I think it's clear that the Trotskyists did make an important contribution to the socialist movement in the US and internationally as well. Firstly, the fact that they broke from Stalin in 1928, even though they knew full well they were going to be isolated, they were going to be persecuted, the fact that they took a stand on the basis of principles meant that, you know, they were able to preserve the genuine tradition of Marxism. That puts at the heart of its project workers' control over society. They hadn't broken. This tradition would have been all the more buried. Secondly, by holding on during those difficult early years, we can see that, you know, the political situation doesn't always remain, you know, flat without much opportunities. There were opportunities that opened up, and the fact that they'd held together through those difficult years meant that they could actually seize those opportunities and they could show us what was possible, you know, in the 1934 Teamsters Rebellion. They could show us what, you know, genuine revolutionary leadership of the working class movement could look like. And I think it showed us that, you know, even despite their small numbers, what important contributions Trotskyists could make to the class struggle, the fact that they played the leading role in the 1934 Teamsters Rebellion, despite being quite small, you know, gives you a sense that, you know, that there are things that organisations can contribute that are really important. But I think undoubtedly it's true that the Trotskyists remain on the margins of the American working class movement generally, and that they were never really able to establish a mass organisation. And I think, you know, it's clear the Trotskyists made mistakes along the way. Perhaps the entry job was a mistake, but the main thing that was blocking their path was the Communist Party. And, you know, the thing about the Communist Party was that despite their massive numbers, their politics were key to, you know, to the defeats of the late 30s and the working class movement. So, you know, size isn't all that matters. Actually, politics is really central. And I think the thing about Cannon and the battles that the Trotskyists made throughout this period was all about trying to, you know, clarify those politics and establish an organisation based on, you know, the politics of self, the self-emancipation of the working class. And that's something that we in Socialist Alternative are attempting to do as well.